This is Second Look, only on 103.3 WZND. Here to take a second look at the stories the WZND Newsroom has covered this week. Investigative reporting from the award-winning WZND News Team, here for you. Unbiased, engaging, and comprehensive. Second Look starts now.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Second Look, the show where we take an in-depth second look at last week's stories. I'm Colleen Holden.
And I'm John Rosny. After nearly half a year since the city and town council elections for the Twin Cities, it can be insightful to follow up on elected members' positions and the progress that they have made while in office. WZND's very own Gavin Broderick interviewed Bloomington City Councilmember newcomer Jenna Kearns and the experience from her first term serving Ward 1 of Bloomington.
How's your general feelings going, 5 months now into your term serving Ward 1?
Yes, it has been a very humbling but exciting experience. There are moments when I just, there's things that it's like, yes, of course I knew it was going to be like this going in, but you really don't know until you're in it, like how complicated issues can be or how challenging it can be, or just, you know that you can't please everyone, but the feeling of not being able to please everyone, it still kind of caught me off guard where, you're doing the best you can and you think you're doing what you can to make the right choices, and you can still feel like there's so much more you could be doing or learning. It's definitely complicated.
Are you enjoying your time? Is it, like, how would you describe, I guess, the feeling of serving in Ward 1?
I love being the representative for Ward 1. I really do. I've really been enjoying my time and getting to hear from members of the community in Ward 1, but also just throughout the city, and getting to a better understanding of how all things, how things connect, or, where my blind spots might be. So we just did the Fire Ops 101 training with the fire department, and it was, again, it was one of those moments where, like, I know their job is hard. I know there's so many things they have to be accountable for and responsible for, and that we lean on them. But, being put in that position and, like, in training scenarios and hearing from them and the maps and data that they showed about, how they try to take care of the city, it just was really eye-opening. So I have always liked learning new things and being exposed to different vantage points and perspectives. And so I hope that I can continue to take all these things that I'm learning and make good decisions.
Now, you mentioned your growing respect for the fire department, learning about that mm-hmm. training. For any portion of the government that perhaps you didn't even think about and is maybe an unsung hero?
Oh, I think really all the departments, but I would say I know that in our community, a good contingency, or just, really vocal community members, we're always wanting our roads to be fixed, and just knowing some of the staff that, they spend a lot of their time devoted to that. And then on top of that, it can't work in a silo. There's all the stuff underneath the roads that, makes it complicated. And so I think our public works department and, those really complex departments that seem pretty straightforward, like fix the roads, have safe drinking water, things like that. But it's just so much more complicated than that. I think we do a good job of trying to show them that they're valued, but I'm sure at times they can feel that, that their best is never good enough.
I think one for me is waste management.
Mm-hmm.
Like, really think about where all the trash goes and, like, how much each person has. It's almost baffling. But, Is there anything that you've done so far that you're particularly proud of?
I would say I know I could do a better job, but I think I feel like I'm doing a good job being very cordial and collegial and reaching out to my fellow council members when I have a question. There was something that we were talking about recently. Somebody had reached out about a development that had gotten voted down a few years ago, and if there was a different appetite on the council now with new members. And so trying to reach out to members on the council who were there at that time, what their perspective was. So as an example, I guess, but I think we're all doing what we can to keep things friendly and open lines of communication. That was something I was worried about in kind of these divisive times. I know it's kind of an overused phrase, but I think our city council and staff are trying to set those types of things aside and really kind of focus on common sense, practical ways to help run the city and not get bogged down in too much of politics.
Yeah, absolutely. And you kind of alluded to it, but there was the last time we spoke to was when in June, when mm-hmm. there was at the project on Washington Street, and there was a problem with union labor because you wanted to fill that lot. Is that something you still think about? Mm-hmm. Do you ever look back on that?
Yes. Because, you know, wondering if that was a good idea. Are there, you know, what can I learn from that experience? And really just, it kind of was the tip of the iceberg of getting a more intimate knowledge of how difficult our current economy and our current position is when it comes to what developers are looking for, what they're willing to do. Because at the end of the day, they want to make money. And so how do you balance that with what makes sense and what we need? And I think I still don't have the answers for that in terms of housing, but you kind of just have to we should have a strategy, but in some ways you just feel like you're taking it, you know, case by case, which can feel frustrating. So I still don't think there are good answers out there on the housing front, given interest rates and things like that. But that one was definitely like the biggest vote that I feel like I've experienced. And so, and it was about housing. So I think that that's kind of I think about it. I kind of measure it up to all the other projects that come before me and kind of my thought process when I was looking at that one.
Do you foresee more tough decisions like that, specifically in regards to the people call it a housing crisis here in town?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Definitely on that end. And then the streetscape plan was just unveiled from the city to get input from community members. And so there's been a lot of effort put into figuring out how we can leverage our downtown and ways to make that more accessible and better for the community, which will drive businesses, will drive interest and development, either on the business side or the housing side. So I think those decisions, you know, they're all so interconnected. So I think that getting that right would be helpful in the housing arena as well. But yeah, I think that this is going to continue to be a problem in our community, and we have to find creative solutions, because with the way interest rates are and, you know, kind of the vantage point of developers, it's not an easy sell to have them pick the type of development and growth that I think would make sense for our community.
Absolutely. Changing topics for a second. I know mm-hmm. 24 is quite a while away now, but mm-hmm. do you have any plans for future political aspirations or outside of Ward 1?
Yeah, I think, so I am filling the rest of Jamie Matthey's term, so these 2 years I always think of as like kind of dipping my toes in the water. It's not a full term that I will have served, and so I definitely thought about the fact that I am interested in running again. And putting my hat in the ring to continue to represent Ward 1, at least for another term. I'm very much in favor of term limits, so I am by no means interested in overstaying my welcome, but I think, you know, one more full term might kind of help see through some of the projects that I see coming through and would like to continue to support some of those. Like I said, the streetscape and the roads and infrastructure and with water and roads, et cetera. So I think that I'd like to stick around a little more, but we'll see what the community has to say about that.
After your next term, though, that'll be, what, 28?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, as a kid, I knew I always wanted to be an attorney, and I did that, and I always liked the idea of running for office. I definitely enjoy working with the city and having that perspective. So I don't know. We'll see. But it might be time for me to step aside and let someone else get in there. But right now, I don't think I have any aspirations to go beyond city council.
Okay. Well, I like to end all my interviews with a fun question. So do you have a favorite local restaurant?
Ooh, that's a good one. So I'll stick to Ward 1, and there's so many. But I would say I love going to Little Beaver Brewery and sitting out on the patio. I love their atmosphere and vibe sitting out on the patio. And then I just had El Rinconcito, the little Mexican restaurant that used to be where Gracie's is. It's on South Main next to the grocery store, the Mexican grocery store.
Well, do you have anything to add before I let you go?
No, I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Bye.
Councilwoman Kearns ran her campaign on key issues such as the development of affordable housing and prioritizing infrastructure projects, and was elected to the position of Ward 1 council member this past spring.
ISU School of Communications professor John McHale recently won an award for his original screenplay, Nurses vs. the Virus. Written in tandem with former nurse and longtime friend Xavier Jackson, McHale went into detail about the film with Ben Howell from the WZND news team.
First question I have for you, you want to tell me just a little bit, a little more in-depth of the plot and kind of how the story of the script is, a little more than surface level knowledge.
Yeah, again, overall, Nurses versus the Virus is about a black male nurse on the front lines during the darkest days of the COVID pandemic. And it really does follow his work in nursing homes. And then he feels a call to help other people during the COVID crisis. So he gets more involved in direct COVID treatment. And that gets very dark when he enters the COVID ICU unit, where he sees multiple people pass away daily as the result of the pandemic and, at that point, the lack of a vaccine. The main character, the protagonist, struggles to do the best work he can and help the most people he can. But it's particularly emotional when he loses a patient that he becomes very close to. And in the meantime, our character is dealing with his own personal demons. He has a temper. He also partakes of alcohol, probably too much. And he faces what can really be a racist or racially insensitive workplace in rural areas like Central Illinois. But he grows through those issues, and he becomes the nurse, the best nurse that he can be, and finds his best place where he can help the most people. And that, in essence, is our story.
And what's the character's name, if you don't mind?
It is Fred, and actually, his name is Fred Hampton. We named him after a very esteemable advocate for the rights of black people, who was assassinated by Cook County police officers and the Illinois Attorney General's office in 1971. So his namesake is a very important figure to my co-author and I. And the state of Illinois and the Cook County Police admitted the wrongful killing in 1983 and gave each of the victims $73,000, or the victims' families. So we named our character after Fred Hampton, who we have tremendous respect for as an historical figure, who, again, was assassinated by the forces that be.
Yeah, I bet that would probably make for a more powerful story with a name like that.
Right. And sometimes it's referenced in the story that, you know, that that the character's namesake was an important figure. But we named him Fred Hampton as an homage to, a very important historical figure for us who was killed by the state of Illinois at age 21.
And going off of that, does the story or the inspiration of Fred Hampton, what was the goal of the script, or what called you to write it? Was it his story, or was there, how did it tie in with COVID? What exactly inspired this script itself?
The story of nurses has not been told in cinema like it needs to be. Time and time again, we see films about doctors. But who does the real medical work? It's nurses. 95% of the care we receive in hospitals, in doctors' offices, come from nurses. But in my research, I could not find a film that celebrated the work of nurses. So nurses were heroes during the COVID epidemic. They were on the front lines of the COVID epidemic. But as we see from the massive strikes recently in California and elsewhere in the United States, nurses don't get their due. They should receive more compensation. They should be recognized for the essential healthcare workers that they are. So my co-author, Xavier Jackson, has been a black nurse for several years, and his personal experiences inform what we wrote in our drama. So his experiences were indispensable. But in essence, the real motivation to write this was to celebrate the work that nurses did to try to help in one of the greatest health crises of the 21st century.
Back to your co-author, what's your history with Xavier Jackson? How did you guys meet? How did you become good friends?
Yeah, I've known Xavier Jackson for about 15 years. I met him through common friends who I had coffee with, and I just hit it off with him immediately. It's amazing how me, you know, a short, white, Irish guy from the south side of Chicago, can be such close friends and share such common sensibility with a 6'7" black man born in Peoria. There's some kind of link between him and I that transcends friendship. And part of that is that we share the same cinematic sensibility. We like the same shows. We like the same culture. We like the same films. We are very close in that way.
All right. Thank you. The next question I have for you, before I switch topics a little bit, but writing can be, like I'm sure as you're very well aware, it can be quite an exhaustive career after rejection and the loss of what you want to happen for, like, a script or any type of piece you have. How does it feel to accept this award after it was selected in top 1% of other entries to the award show, or the award submission, I mean?
I am so grateful to be in such a supportive academic environment, which has allowed me to write over 30 film and TV scripts over the past 15 to 20 years. And I have received a number of awards and accolades for, many of the scripts that I've written. But I feel at this point, and I don't want to sound overconfident, but it becomes easier the longer and more you do it. It's been suggested that if you do something for 10,000 hours, you become good at it. And I feel like I'm approaching that 10,000-hour mark because, for me, it is not labor to write. It is a joy to write. And maybe I sometimes hide in the writing because I get to create a whole world. And with just slight adjustments of lines and scenes, that world can be changed to be a more effective drama for the audience. So it is very validating that the jury at the Santa Barbara Film Festival decide to confer this honor upon us.
Awesome. The last question I have for you, like we covered a little bit earlier, Xavier Jackson's experience so very important to the writing of the story, but I wanted to know, what do you believe are the most imperative lessons you took away both for writing the script and for yourself as a person?
Well, the first thing I learned from Xavier Jackson, how hard it is to be a black man in America. The standard set in sensitivity fueled by possible racial prejudice remains in our country and is present in the medical profession. It's easy as a white man to take for granted the presumption I get in my favor. What working with Xavier Jackson did was made me aware, and I've always been aware, but increased my awareness of how there's a significant portion of our population that's composed of people of color that don't always get the presumption or benefits that white America fully gets. The second thing I learned from Xavier Jackson was how emotionally draining, how strenuous, and how psychologically difficult it would be to work in an environment where multiple people are dying daily from a disease that was greatly helped by the vaccine. Those are the big things I learned, I think, is how hard it is to be a nurse, but how much harder it is to be a nurse when you're a male black nurse. The unfairness in perception that sometimes rears its ugly head.
Mikhail has been a professor at ISU for several years now and has won many film awards while teaching here.
We're going to take a quick break. Afterwards, we got an additional interview to recap, including the success of Redbirds volleyball coach Allie Matters and recent news and sports developments over the weekend. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Second Look, only on WZND.
Welcome back to this week's edition of Second Look. I'm your co-host, John Rosny. So far, we've heard interviews with a newcomer council member in Bloomington and her experiences on the job, as well as an interview with an ISU professor about his award-winning film, Nurses Versus the Virus.
In local news, marijuana legalization in Illinois has come with increased pot-involved deadly crashes and a rise in accidental ingestion among children. A new study has found the state's annual cannabis report for 2023 that the rate of fatal crash drivers who tested positive for marijuana rose from 25% in 2 years before legalization to 37% in 2020, the first year the recreational sales were available in Illinois. The report also highlighted some benefits, included decrease in marijuana-related arrests and in opioid and benzodiazepine-related fatalities. In other local news, two liquor stores near the campus of Illinois State University were burglarized in the early morning hours on Saturday, according to Normal Police. Police Sergeant Rob Cherry reported two 707 liquors were broken into where several bottles of alcohol as well as one cash register were stolen. Police are still investigating information related to a suspect.
In local sports, the Normal High Ironmen has maintained their perfect record after sweeping Peoria Manuel High School with a score of 42-0. The Ironmen play next against Friday against Argo Community High School. In Redbirds football action, ISU lost to Youngstown State last night by a score of 41-38. This puts the Redbirds record at 4-3 going into a game against UNI next Saturday.
And speaking of Redbird sports, following a tough start to the season, the Redbird volleyball team has been plowing their way through the Missouri Valley Conference, with head coach Allie Matters hitting her 100th career win last Monday against rival Bradley and sweeping Indiana State with a 20-point lead in the final set. Jamison Warfield from the WZND News and Sports team and I were on the call and attended a press conference with Allie Matters and a few members of the team.
All right, coach, players, Deidre, please help us some comments on tonight's Redbirds and successful 5 match home stand.
Yeah, we did it. We knew that this, you know, 5 match home stand was going to be really big for us, and we knew we were lucky to have it. So I thought tonight we were a little flat. I just thought we were a little bit more error prone than we have been the last couple of matches, but we had a really good time out and just a little bit more attention to detail, a little bit more discipline, and I thought the result of the third set really showed what we are capable of when we are playing well. I mean, we dug 63 balls as a team, which is really good for us. We blocked 12 balls, and we sided out 100% in the third set, so I thought that it was another really good team win.
Good. So we'll open up to questions from the media.
Definitely. 9 straight wins after an 0-9 start. How does it feel to really turn your season around at this point?
How do you think it feels? it's really unbelievable, and I just think that I remember after our home tournament, and we just were in a really, really tough place, and we knew that we were starting against Drake and UNI, we were going to Green Bay, and we just kind of made a commitment to not bail on each other, and I'll just keep remembering that, because I was like, everyone needs to make a promise. We're not, coaches aren't bailing on you, you're not bailing on each other, you're not bailing on ourselves, and that was just kind of a moment of impact, because we just all agreed in that moment that we would figure it out. It just took us a lot longer than we originally planned, but now that we're in the position that we are, we can't help but to reflect on that start and that we're moving forward.
Cassie, you think helping out with the block tonight, have you ever allowed only 5 points in a set before?
Not that I can recall, no. it felt really good. I think there was a lot of trust up there at the net between the pin blockers in the middle. It's just talking and feeling each other's presence and just being a force.
Maggie getting a start on the defensive end too. What did you do to kind of help your team as a unit?
Yeah, like Cassie said, the blocking was really good, and I think that having good block setups really helped the defense set around that, so made my job a lot easier, and just went for every ball.
Caitlin getting out there a little bit tonight and last night. How's it feel to really get your first real swings with ISU?
Honestly, it feels really good. When I come on the court, like, there's so much energy, and I just feel like everything's, like, how it should be when I go on the court. So it's been fun.
Great. 9 wins. Going into facing UNI and Drake next weekend, what is the mindset like as a team looking to improve?
Yeah, I think that the first time we played them, like, I feel like that feels like forever ago, and just the way that we were playing as a team is so significantly different than the first time we played them. So I feel like we are a lot more prepared, and we kind of talked about it last night, is that every time we take the floor, we're trying to get better as a team, we're trying to do things different, we're trying to scout differently, we're doing our best to stay in system and keep our offense as efficient as we possibly can. So it's a really, really big weekend, and we're back on the road, but regardless of what we're doing right now, like, we are still the underdog. So to go into an environment that on paper we're not supposed to win those matches is just adding more fuel to our fire. And we're going to do our best this week to prepare for 2 really good opponents.
So you guys started off the season with some pretty tough losses, but you really turned it around with, like, your 9-set streak, taking on Valparaiso and, like, beating Bradley. How did you guys turn that around for the better?
I think for me, a really memorable kind of turning point in our season was the 5-setter at Murray State. We kind of had a choice to make around that third set of just if we're going to fight, we're going to go for it, or if we're going to roll over and let them take it. And I think from that moment, we proved to ourselves, okay, we can do this, and we've just been hot ever since. So I think it was just kind of showing ourselves what we're capable of in that moment.
One more question. It was really close in the first set, but you guys really cleaned it up, I mean, obviously, with that gigantic lead in the first set.
How did you guys really pull it together in this game specifically?
I feel like we were kind of, after that first set, we were like, all right, we need to start controlling what we can control, which is our side, not the other side. So, like, just the us versus us mentality and controlling our game really helped.
Cassie, you had 6 kills tonight. Hannah had 8, both with no errors. What were the middle two? Just avoid attack errors and hit effectively.
I think we're working on seeing the block really well, and our connection with Emily, we've been working on it all season. It's really good. There's a lot of trust between the setter and us, and when it's a good pass, just going in hard and expecting to get the ball has been helping a lot, and then just kind of the scouting report, knowing where their defense is, what they're doing, and where their open holes are to find.
Coach, their position group kind of single out, has kind of helped you along the route, or is it just everyone right now?
I think it's everyone. I mean, I don't, you know, they're... I feel like we have different people that are maybe hotter one night, but when you're distributing the ball like Emily is, it's just, you can't really ignore anyone, and I think that's what makes you and I really good. I think that's what makes Drake really good, is that you can't leave anyone by themselves. So I think, you know, we're really heavy on the pin right now to, like, Ada, Bella, Kara. So we want to get Cassie, we want to get Hannah more involved, because it just opens up more opportunities for our pin attackers. So our distribution is really good.
The Redbird volleyball team will be hitting the road to take on UNI and Drake in the coming weeks as they try to keep their winning streak alive.
Today we look back at the interviews with a new member of the Bloomington City Council, discussions with an award-winning communications professor at ISU, and the landmark success of the Redbirds volleyball coach. Tune in this time next week to listen to October's edition of Bird's Eye View and the WZND's news team's investigative journalism. I'm John Rosny.
And I'm Colleen Holden.
This has been WZND's Second Look. Catch more WZND in-depth news every Sunday at noon with WZND's Bird's Eye View and Second Look. For more WZND news, find us online at WZND.com.